Hey friends, I want to thank our sponsor, Raygun. Are you struggling to replicate the bugs and performance issues that your customers are reporting? Plug Raygun into your web and mobile applications right now and diagnose problems in minutes rather than hours. Kiss goodbye having to dig through log files and relying on frustrated users to report issues. Make your software development life so much easier using Raygun's error, crash, and performance monitoring tools. Every software team can create flawless software experiences for their customers with Raygun. Try it free today at raygun.com. That's RAYGUN.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Sharon Steed. She's the CEO at Communilog and the author of Empathy at Work. And I first learned about Sharon when I saw her TEDx talk. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm very happy to be talking to you. We have been digital friends now for many, many years. And I've watched you just kicking butt all over the internet. And I saw your TEDx talk some years ago. But you've been thinking about the space of empathy and, you know, building collaborative environments for many years before you kind of blew up in the TEDx space.
Yeah, for sure. I actually got it started speaking back in 2014. So it's been about 5 years now. I gave that TEDx talk in 2016, and I got started speaking on the advice of a speech therapist I was seeing at the time. I'm a person who stutters, and so I had sort of like come to this spot where, you know, I was so uncomfortable just like talking that I would avoid social situations. I would avoid talking to people. And it was, you know, quite frankly, just destroying my career. And so she suggested I pursue like public speaking as a way to sort of just face the fear. And so, you know, I, of course, being me, was like, absolutely not. And then after she like packed me off of the ledge and said, don't worry, it's not going to kill you, I said, okay, sure. And so that's kind of how the whole thing began, was just as a way to sort of, you know, face a fear and see if I could do it or not.
When you're, you know, at a speech therapist who is talking to you about how to, you know, adjust this affecting situation, and then they say, "Oh, you know what you should do? International keynote speaker. That would be a great idea." Like, what are you thinking at this moment?
Well, so here's the thing: like, it wasn't, "Hey, you should like go on a plane and you should fly to, you know, Sydney and give a talk in front of like 1,000 developers." No. It was like, how about you go and speak to a fluency seminar, like at a graduate, you know, college, and just talk to them about, you know, like your experiences as a person who stutters. And so, you know, in my mind, I mean, I had spent my like entire life, and I'm not kidding, like grade school, you know, like high school, college, like avoiding, you know, these kinds of situations. And so for her to sort of present this idea was just like, why? Like, why would I voluntarily, you know, like do this thing that has traumatized me, I don't know how many times, my entire life? And so just in my mind, it was just like, there's no way that that could even work, even a little bit. And so that's what I was thinking. And I had no idea that it was going to turn into, you know, the thing that it's turned into now. No clue.
The idea that one would or could take something that was affecting them and turn it into, I don't know, is it fair to say it's an asset? I mean, does it get you recognized? It's like, oh yeah, I saw you. Like, you're the woman who stutters. Or does that make it worse?
Oh no. I actually think it's made it better. And like, in all of my talks now, like, I sort of talk about my like poignant, you know, moments along the way, like that have sort of taught me about communication as a person who stutters, and then just communication, like as a person in a world that is just like increasingly divided, right? And so, another sort of high product of speaking has been actually me just getting a lot more comfortable talking about stuttering and stuttering in general. And I wasn't expecting that to be the case. I mean, I thought, you know, I was always just going to be uncomfortable with how I spoke. And so I didn't know that there was a way to sort of speak freely and stutter at the same time until I became a public speaker.
Mm-hmm. When I, and forgive me if this is a bad analogy, but let's try this. When I was diagnosed type 1 diabetic, I didn't know anything about this situation. And I went and I was at work and I told a bunch of people and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I went to the doctor today. Diabetic. I got these needles. Look at my needles. And I was young and I was telling everyone all about this and what a fascinating and horrible thing it was. And it was because it was the thing in my life. And a woman in accounting pulled me aside, like in a hushed tone into an alleyway. And she was like, don't talk about this. What are you doing? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm diabetic, but they don't know because they're gonna take away your insurance and they're gonna they might think you're weak and they're not gonna give you assignments because they know that you've got this thing. And she, for about 2 years, taught me to be consciously, visibly ashamed of this thing that I just thought was a thing. Like I thought everyone has something, mm-hmm. and it messed me up for a pretty good amount of time. But then when I started doing speaking and I would have, you know, a low blood sugar or have to fix my pump or stab a needle in myself on stage, I would have people come up afterwards and say, wow, it's so nice to see a visible diabetic. In today's world, is it good to be a visible blank, whatever your thing is? Like we've got supermodels with vitiligo and we have international keynote speakers who stutter. Like everybody's got something. Is that a good thing?
Oh yeah. I mean, of course it is. I think that the more people who are, a little bit different, a little bit outside of the box, who are, you know, like out there doing a thing that people don't think that they can do because of, you know, blank, I think that that's a great thing. I mean, I think that we're telling kids, I think that we're telling adults that, like, you know, all of us are, you know, we all have our own things, right? We all have our own insecurities, our own disabilities, and you don't have to be quiet about those things. Those things are actually kind of a benefit to us because they give us a different perspective and they can show the world a different perspective, right? I mean, it also helps you to connect with people who you didn't think that you had anything in common with, mm-hmm. and you know have some sort of common ground. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, how many people have like come up to me, when I've spoken and said, yeah, you know, I stutter too. And, you know, I have had a really challenging time, like speaking up at work or, you know, taking phone calls. Like I just like constantly avoid talking on the phone and seeing you, you know, be on stage and be confident and be comfortable like that, you know, just gives me, it gives me a feeling that I can, you know, speak with confidence and that it's okay. And so, yes, you know, of course, I think that the more that we make things invisible, the more that we give those things power over us and over our choices. And I think that we should, you know, do everything we can to sort of take that power back.
Yeah. And if, let me ask you this, though. Like, it feels like it takes a lot of willpower. Like, I was, you know, every couple of years, I'll be honest with you, I will have a crying day. It's not all the time, but it's just like every couple of years, diabetes just gets me down and like the well of willpower goes away. And it's just like, you know, I just can't today. And you just want a break, right? It's been 27 years and it's just like, I need one day where I can have a freaking cookie. And then I cry and I get over it and then I move on. Not everyone has a well of willpower that is as deep as someone else's. How do you teach someone that, like, well, they might say, well, Sharon's, you know, she's on stage, but she's got that power. She's got that something that I don't have. How do we teach others to have that ability as well?
Right. I mean, like, it's such a small thing, right? Like, I just want a cookie and now I'm crying about it. However, I have those exact same moments. I was at a party a couple of weeks ago. And so people who stutter, like, the one word that we can't kid around is our name. And so when we are introducing ourselves, he can't say, hi, well, I'm this awesome person, blah, 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 and I do this and this and that. No, it's like, I have to say, hi, I'm Sharon. And like, occasionally, it doesn't come out as quickly as it should. And so people kind of give you this like, oh, this is weird. I'm either going to laugh at you because I'm uncomfortable, or I'm just going to completely avoid you because I'm uncomfortable. And so I was at this party and we, you know, are like going around and saying, hi, you know, I'm so-and-so, hi, I'm so-and-so. And then I, you know, said, hi, I'm Sharon. And a woman who I was talking to just like, was like, oh, hi. And then she just avoided me for the entire night. And I remember going up to my husband and being like, I want to leave. Like, I was so upset. I was so overwhelmed with just like, this is so embarrassing. I'm so ashamed. Why do like I have to stutter? Like, I just want to be normal. Like, I just want to go to a party and say my name and have fun and have good conversations. And so, I mean, I think that when, you know, people see people, you know, like you and like I, as strong and confident all of the time. Well, they're only seeing a very, very, very small part of, you know, like our lives, right? Like on Twitter or on stages or on these podcasts, like that's only like a very small part of us. You know, I have to be this person. You have to be this person all day, every day. And there are times when I don't feel strong. Like there are times when I'm just not gonna call anyone because I really don't feel like having to talk to someone right now because it's gonna be hard and my life is so hard and like I'm just gonna stay in bed because this is the worst, right? And so I don't know. I mean, I think that people kind of view willpower as strength. And I don't see those things on the same plane. I feel like having willpower is, you know, kind of peaks and valleys. It's like I have awesome days and I feel confident and I feel amazing and I feel really, 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 really strong and tough. And then it's on those days when I do feel weak and I do feel small and I choose to continue, to continue pursuing a thing or, you know, go on stage anyway or take that call anyway. Like that's willpower. Like that's like real, true strength.
You know, I really appreciate that you pointed that out. I had not thought about that before, that I think I primitively had thought of willpower as being strength and that I was weak if I didn't have it. Let's flip the idea that willpower is not strength. There's not a direct axis there, and flip that on its head and think about your book and your report at O'Reilly, Empathy at Work. If willpower is not strength, does that mean that empathy is not weakness?
I mean, I feel that, and that's a great question. I know I get a lot of people who sort of come up to me and say, like, well, like that touchy feely soft skill thing, is it really all that important? And I say, well, yeah, I mean, well, one, because like these quote unquote soft skills, and I absolutely despise that term, those are the only skills that you are going to consistently need throughout your career. And then, you know, like at, you know, your parents' house or with your kids or with your spouses or with your friends, like these are the things that sort of like further relationships and, you know, build solid connections. And so, you know, like how can a thing like empathy, you know, be equated to weakness when it's such a powerful connector, and it helps us to really like lay the foundation for, you know, pursuing understanding other people's perspectives and other people's opinions. Like those things don't make us weak. They make us better. They improve us as people. They expand our minds. And all of those things are going to help us, you know, truly connect with others. How can that possibly be a weakness?
Sick of waiting for your CI tests to pass or having to manage different CI servers for different teams? Using BuildKite, you can run fast and reliable CI pipelines for every type of project, whether it's back-end tests, mobile apps, or even custom hardware. BuildKite's agent helps you scale to thousands of parallel jobs, and your secrets and source code never leave your infrastructure. There's great documentation, a clean web UI, and plugins for different types of tools. Visit BuildKite, that's KITE.com/Hanselman, for a 14-day free trial and see how Shopify scaled from 300 to 1,500 engineers while keeping their build times under 5 minutes. That's BuildKite.com/Hanselman. Is it something that can be taught? My wife and I are kind of deep in the middle of the tween years. I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. And, you know, at this moment in time, you know, I love my kids, but they're just jerks. Just awful, awful little people, you know, because they have zero empathy of any kind. And I'm, you know, in your book, you actually call out three types of empathy: emotional empathy, cognitive empathy, and empathetic concern. They effectively have none of these things, except maybe they can manipulate us using empathy as like a tool. What we're looking for them to really have is primarily cognitive empathy, which you say is perspective taking. And unfortunately, as you point out in your report, that's the kind of empathy that requires work, and little boys don't like to work.
Yeah, no, I mean, the research shows that like a lot of these things that we're talking about, you know, now, like aren't just inherent. And if you think about it, you know, like we're sort of evolutionarily, like we are protectors of, you know, ourselves and our tribes. And so when we are faced with an outsider, we are not like attempting to like understand them. It's almost like a fight or flight sort of reaction, right? And so like this is a skill that, you know, the vast majority of us like have to sort of learn as we go. And we have to sort of like take the time to really pause and to really think about, you know, like where other people are coming from and fill in the gaps of the things that we don't know, or you just kind of have to accept like that we don't have all of the context, and, you know, have to assume that other people are coming from a good place. All of those things are not things that are inherent in us. And so it does require some trial and error and a whole lot of work, unfortunately.
I never really thought about the idea that it isn't intuitive to some folks because it may be evolutionarily not a beneficial thing. Like, it depends on the world you live in. If you are in a cave and mm-hmm. your focus is the three people in your space, then yeah, you should be empathetic towards those three people and everyone else is an enemy. But in a connected right. global world, it's actually quite useful to, and certainly in a world of social media, being empathetic towards people is only a good thing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially now when we're, you know, constantly bombarded with, you know, like all kinds of news and all kinds of content and all kinds of opinions. A lot of those opinions, you're just like, I don't agree with that. How am I supposed to, you know, like heal like with these feelings? I mean, I feel like we've gotten to a point where like if we're confronted with the person who like doesn't agree with us on, you know, like a few obvious topics, then we just don't want to talk to them at all. And that is the complete opposite of, you know, trying to pursue understanding and like trying to get perspective. We live in a world like that makes empathy incredibly difficult. And so, you know, like we have to work quite a bit harder in order to, you know, achieve our goals of like truly connecting with people, especially if we disagree with them. Mm.
I'm hoping that the boys are going to learn empathy on their own, but I'm going to keep trying to explain it to them. I don't think having them read your research paper is going to work for an 11-year-old, but I'm going to do the best. We may assign this as homework, in fact.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, why not? You know, you might as well get them started young. I'm sure they would love that.
I think they would. Well, you call it out, right? It's learned. It's not innate. Like, some empathy is built into our brains, mm-hmm. but the most of it is how we're learned. And it's difficult. If you've had a tough life and life has beaten you up, I'm sure that would probably beat the empathy out of you.
Or, I mean, like, it could do the entirely, you know, opposite thing and force you to be incredibly empathetic. I mean, I know people who stutter, who kind of view fluent people as like, wow, you know, like your life is so easy. How can you ever be uncomfortable talking on the phone? How can you ever be uncomfortable getting up on stage? And I'm like, you guys, hold on. Like, these things that we're doing, like me, every time I get on stage, I'm not just concerned about stuttering. You know, I'm concerned about the content I am delivering, right? Like, I mean, every time like I have to hop on like a conference call, you know, I'm, you know, of course concerned about stuttering, but I'm also concerned about, you know, getting across my point and convincing clients that, you know, like the thing that that I want to do for their company, you know, is going to work for them. And so, I mean, I think it depends on, you know, who that person is. Either they're going to be like, wow, your life is really easy and you don't have any problems, or it's going to force them to sort of take a step back and say like, hey, like, I kind of understand, you know, how you could feel that, you know, like this is an uncomfortable situation. And, you know, I can empathize with that.
Yeah. I think one of the important things is that, and I always encourage people, is try to avoid playing the oppression Olympics. This is not a point-based system.
That's such a great term. I'm going right? to use that.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So like, I have type 1 diabetes. Okay. So what? Right. I got all this. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, but here's the thing, right? But we are in a country that can support us. We are in a time that can support us. I mean, you want to talk about who would be a lousy caveman, right? I got LASIK. I would be the blind diabetic eating lettuce in the back of the cave, you know?
Yeah, that's so true.
So we're very lucky. And I think that empathy is also applying these things to yourself. Like, everybody's got something, and what a wonderful time it is that we can we can all just survive together. One thing that you said there, I had not heard that term. You called us the fluent. I've called people the normally sugared or just the normals. Someone at work is like, can you eat that cake? And it's just like, oh, you normals.
Yeah. you kids, get off my lawn.
Exactly. I know that there are people, for example, in the deaf and the hard of hearing community who have some kind of feeling about someone who might get a cochlear implant. Are there things in the stuttering community that can... I've heard about hearing aids that talk back into your ear. Is there a push a button and fix it option? And is that considered a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, so I know that there are the hearing aids, and I know that those, you know, do work for some people. However, I've heard that, like, after a certain time period, like, they stop working. Other than that, I haven't heard that there's any cure for it. And I think that people are, like, trying to find a cure. I was actually seeing a therapist who said that he helped, you know, one of his clients cure stuttering by, like, complete accident. And he did it by putting him on some sort of, like, anti-anxiety pills. And then the client was also smoking a lot of medical marijuana. And so that combination actually cured stuttering for him. Now, the therapist was like, look, I don't suggest going out and getting a lot of weed and smoking it, but I'm just saying there's a way that we could help you stutter less.
And I mean, oh, yeah. Who knows the side effects, though?
I mean, who knows? Yeah, exactly. I think that the community is kind of split. I mean, so we have this conference. It's called the National Stuttering Association Conference, and it's every year around the 4th of July. And so, like, a lot of the people that stutter, like, they kind of come from all over the world to sort of just connect and to go to different workshops and hear talks and, you know, like, all of that stuff. And so there are people there who say, like, I would take a pill and then I would have it go away. And then there's a lot of other people there who are like, I would never take a pill because stuttering is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Now, I'm a person who could probably say that this is the best thing that's ever happened to me, but if I could take a pill to maybe, like, not stutter, like, 98% of the time, I would consider taking that pill. I mean, I just think it makes my, like, day-to-day life way easier. However, I mean, I kind of, like, can't imagine me personally, like, my life without stuttering. I mean, I don't know where I would be. So, it depends on who you talk to. Some people are like, I'm going to stutter for life. And others are like, just give me the pill. Give me the pill.
we always talk about this in the diabetes community. Like, if they cure me tomorrow, I would still be pricking my fingers and checking my blood sugar because I would not believe it was true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can so tell. I would be diabetic at heart. I would eat cookies. And then I would just check my blood sugar. And be like, that's amazing. My blood sugar's been perfect for, like, all this time. So you have a company called Communalog, and you do basically empathy. It's an empathy consultancy. Are you giving workshops and traveling around to companies? People can hire you to talk about these things?
Yeah. So I began as a speaker. And so, you know, I was talking about, improving communication with empathy. And then it kind of just shifted into, like, going into companies and working with, you know, like, either their teams or doing, like, breakouts at their, like, internal company events, like, where we sort of have these discussions around, like, how to engage empathy at work in an impactful way. And I work with companies on sort of improving communication, collaboration, you know, through operationalizing empathy on their teams and, like, in their departments. and in their organizations as a whole. And so the breakouts I do are between 60 minutes and 3 hours. And so we try to get a lot done. And I think that the thing that I've learned the most, I mean, so I am coming from like a speaker keynote sort of background. And so, you know, I only have like 30 minutes, 45 minutes. But like doing these workshops, you know, I didn't realize just how desperately people in, you know, companies and in the corporate space are just trying to like have conversations around empathy and insecurities and vulnerability. I mean, you know, your employees want to talk about these things. And so I'm the person that companies bring in to sort of create a space to have those conversations.
The thing that I thought was the most powerful or kind of surprising about what you just said was you said
operationalizing.
It's hard to say for anybody. Forgive me.
I don't know if I made that word up.
I think it's pretty awesome. Operationalizing empathy. Because you're not just coming in and saying, hey, let's talk about squishy things. You're saying, let's optimize business outcomes. And like being pleasant and facilitating conversations around empathy can actually help your business. Shocker. Shocker.
I know, right? A lot of people like I don't believe in it are just like, well, how is this going to help my business? Well, do you want your teams to collaborate more? Do you want your teams to be more productive? Well, they're not going to be, you know, like highly collaborative or productive if they don't get along well, or even if they like completely can't stand each other, like they have to respect each other. And empathy, you know, is going to increase all of those things. And it's just going to help collaboration, communication, all of those good things. It's just going to help it just go much smoother.
Have you ever come into a company and presented this information to them and they just sit there with their arms crossed and then just storm out at the end and they're like, yeah, okay, I just did this workshop.
So it actually happened one time, and it wasn't at a company, it was at a conference. And so I have to give you just like a little bit of background on this. So it was the first time I had given any sort of content like this. It was all day, and it was in Estonia. So every possible carrier I could have to succeeding, I had it. And long story short here, it did not go well at all. And I remember calling one of my other consultant friends and being like, I can't do this. Like, I'm not good at this. I'm just going to stick to keynotes. And she was like, okay, look, calm down. Like, let's talk about like who you are, like what you bring to the table, and you know, like what you do well. And it turns out, you know, all of the answers to that, to those questions, are all of the things that I did not do when I was giving this like full day workshop to a culture that's completely different from mine. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, like after that first time of, you know, learning, like, look, like I'm not gonna, you know, tell you anything that like you don't already know. All right. Like I am here to, you know, create the space for conversations. I'm not here to teach you anything. Like I want you guys to be able to solve your own problems. I'm not the problem solver. I'm just the vehicle. And so after I got that down, yeah, and it was fine. It was great actually. But that first time, man, let me tell you, that was a rough day and a couple weeks after.
that actually hits me pretty hard because I'm supposed to be in Estonia next week. So now I'm going to have to give some real thought.
No, it'll be fine. Yeah. You'll be fine. It was just me. I was just wholly unprepared for every single thing that I was walking into.
And well, so and I think it's really cool that you are conscious of that because Estonia is great and your empathy now has to go two ways because you have to put yourself in their heads. And,
oh, absolutely.
And you probably learned a lot and you're a better speaker for it.
Oh, absolutely. 1,000%.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon Steed, empathy and inclusion expert and CEO at Communilog, for chatting with me today.
Oh, of course. Thank you. It was an incredible conversation, and I'm so happy I was finally able to get to talk to you online and not just talk to you through words on a page.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. I'll make sure to put all the details and how you can get a hold of Sharon and have her speak at your company in the show notes. Again, her company is called Communalog. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.